Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We are trying something a little different today.
We are.
Usually we grab a stack of articles, maybe a book or two, and we synthesize a narrative for you. But today, we are on a specific mission. We're conducting what we're calling a study dive.
That's right. This session is designed specifically for those of you who are, you know, just getting your feet wet in econometrics, or maybe you're a practitioner who just wants to brush up on the absolute fundamentals of multiple regression.
Yeah, we're really going to get into the weeds today.
Are we all?
We are moving from the abstract to the concrete. We have a stack of case studies here, real data sets, real historical puzzles, and we're going to use them to see how these regression models actually work out in the wild.
Mm-hmm.
But before we even get to the numbers, let's frame the problem. I mean, why does this matter? Why do we even need these complex equations?
It matters because the world is just incredibly messy. You know, if you're a chemist, you have a laboratory. You can control the temperature, the pressure, the volume. You change one thing, your independent variable, and you just watch what happens to the reaction, the dependent variable.
That's that phrase, ceteris paribus, all else being equal.
Exactly. All else is equal because you, the scientist, made it equal.
But in economics and social science, we don't have a lab. We have the real world. And in the real world, I mean, all else is never equal.
Never.
Things are happening all at the same time. You know, schools have good teachers, sure, but those same schools might also have wealthier parents or, you know, better facilities.
Or factories buy new machines, but they also hire more workers simultaneously. Prices go up, but maybe unemployment goes up too.
Exactly. Everything is moving at once. So if you just look at two things moving together, you're almost guaranteed to get fooled.
You are. You need tools to cut through that noise. You need a statistical way to hold things constant when the real world refuses to do it for you. And, well, that's what multiple regression is.
It's a mathematical laboratory.
It is. That's a great way to put it.
So today, we're looking at how we build that laboratory. And we're not just looking for the answers. We're strictly looking at the methodology. We're going to talk about transforming data with logs.
We'll be dealing with some messy errors.
And the absolute nightmare that is omitted variable bias.
Yeah, that's a big one. We've got a roadmap set up for this hour. We're going to start with education policy in California and really try to understand the massive trap of confusing correlation with causation in school performance.
And from there, we're heading to the factory floor to look at the Cobb-Douglas production function.
Which I promise is more exciting than it sounds.
It sounds a little dry, but it's actually the perfect example of how to handle nonlinear curves because, spoiler alert, the world isn't always a straight line.
It is not. Then we'll tackle a famous macroeconomic mystery, the Phillips curve. This is a story of a bit of hubris, really. We'll see how a model that worked perfectly for 20 years suddenly just broke, caused a lot of economic chaos, and how econometricians had to fix it by finding the missing variable.
And we'll wrap up with a detailed tour of some of the more advanced causal methods, randomized control trials, difference in differences, regression discontinuity. These are kind of the heavy hitters for when simple regression just isn't enough.
It's a packed agenda.
It is. So let's unpack this. Let's start with case study number one, school performance.
Right. This is a classic starting point for multiple regression because it deals with the question everyone, you know, kind of intuitively understands and cares about. How do we encourage schools to be better?
Right. And to answer that, we're looking at a data set called API 99. This covers 807 high schools in the state of California. Back in the year 1999.
And the metric everyone is obsessed with here is the API, the Academic Performance Index.
Just to give you a sense of the scale, the API ranges from 200 to 1,000, and the state's goal is for schools to score above 800.
So if you don't improve, the state intervenes. It's a high-stakes environment.
For sure. So imagine you're a policymaker in Sacramento in 1999. You look at the spreadsheet. You want to know what drives high scores.
Mm.
And let's start where most people start, with a simple, single explanation. We call this bivariate analysis. We're just going to look at one specific variable, EdParent.
Which stands for the average years of schooling of the parents of the students at that particular school.
Okay, so we run a simple regression. API score on the y-axis, parent education on the x-axis. We get a result. The coefficient comes out to 79.53. Now, stop there. Explain what that number actually, you know, represents in the real world.
Okay, so in a linear regression like this, that coefficient is just the slope of the line. It means that for every one additional year of average parent education. So think of the difference between parents finishing high school versus completing 1 year of college.
Right.
The school's API score jumps by nearly 80 points.
That is massive. The whole scale is 200 to 1,000. An 80-point jump is like a whole letter grade almost.
It is huge. And if you look at the R-squared, which, you know, tells us how much of the variance in the data is explained by our model, it's 0.835.
Wait, hang on. 0.835, that means 83.5%.
83.5%.
Of the difference between a good school and a bad school in this data set can be predicted just by looking at how long the parents went to school.
That's what the bivariate model suggests, yeah.
That sounds, that sounds kind of depressing. If I'm a policymaker looking at that, I'm thinking, why do I even bother funding teacher training? Why do I bother with textbooks?
Exactly.
It implies the schools themselves are basically irrelevant. Is the data actually saying that, or is the model lying to us?
The model isn't lying, but it's definitely misleading us. It's telling us there's a massive association. But remember, we aren't holding anything else constant.
Oh, okay.
We're ignoring poverty, we're ignoring language barriers, we're ignoring class size. And because we're ignoring them, this parent education variable is basically taking credit for all of it.
It's taking credit for the work of other variables. It's soaking up their effect.
Exactly. That's the perfect way to think about it. So we have to move to multiple regression. We're going to add more variables to the equation to see what happens to that parent education number.
Hmm.
We're going to force the math to share the credit.
Okay, so let's construct the new model. We're adding meals. That's the percentage of students on free or reduced lunch, which is the standard proxy for poverty.
Right.
We're adding Englearn, the percentage of students who are English learners. And we're adding teacher variables, CredTeach, which is fully credentialed teachers, and EmerTeach, emergency credentialed teachers.
Okay, so now when we run this new, bigger regression, we're essentially asking a much more sophisticated question. We're asking, what is the effect of parent education holding constant poverty, language, and teacher credentials?
So does the parent effect disappear? I mean, does it drop to zero once we factor in poverty?
It does not. The coefficient drops, but only slightly. It goes from 79.53 down to 73.94.
Wow, that's surprising. I really would have thought poverty would eat up most of that signal.
It eats up some of it, but not that much. And get this, the T statistic for parent education in this full model is 40.29.
40.29, usually we get excited if a t-stat is over 2.
Right. A t-stat of 2 means you're roughly 95% confident the effect isn't zero. A t-stat of 40 is. It's just astronomically high.
It's a sure thing.
It's statistically significant beyond any shadow of a doubt.
Yeah.
So even when you compare two schools with the exact same poverty level and the exact same number of English learners, if one has parents with more education, that school is predicted to score about 74 points higher.
So parents really do matter. But here's where it gets frustrating for me as the hypothetical policymaker. What about the teachers? We added CredTeach, the percentage of fully credentialed teachers. Surely that has to matter.
You would think so. But in this model, the coefficient for CredTeach is small. It's 0.287, and the p-value is 0.268.
A p-value of 0.26, that is way above the standard cutoff of 0.05.
Correct. It means the result is not statistically significant. So, according to this specific model, we can't reject the idea that credentialed teachers have zero effect on test scores.
That just seems completely counterintuitive. Does this mean teacher credentials actually don't matter, or is there something wrong with our microscope here?
It's almost certainly the microscope. This brings us to a really critical methodological concept, collinearity, or, you know, multicollinearity.
Okay, break that down. What is happening under the hood of the model?
Collinearity happens when your independent variables, so the things on the right side of your equation, are highly correlated with each other.
Okay.
In this data set, if you look at the correlation matrix, EdParent, parent education, is strongly negatively correlated with English learners. The correlation is 9.71.
Right. And EdParent is also correlated with meals, I assume?
It is. So what that means is that schools with highly educated parents tend to have very few English learners and very few kids on free lunch. And schools with less educated parents tend to have higher poverty rates.
The variables all move together in a pack.
Exactly. The variables move together. And ideally, the regression wants to see what happens when parent education is high, but poverty is also high. It needs that contrast to separate the effects.
Right.
But if those combinations rarely exist in the data, if high education almost always comes with low poverty, the model just struggles to mathematically isolate the signal for each one.
I like the analogy of an orchestra. It's like you're trying to listen to just the violin, but a cello is playing the exact same melody at the exact same time. You can hear the music. You know the API score is going up. But you can't tell mathematically which instrument is making which sound.
That is a perfect analogy. This socioeconomic signal, that combination of parents, meals, and language, is so loud and so intertwined that it just washes out the more subtle signal of school inputs, like teacher credentials.
But we do see some teacher effect, right? I saw Emmer teach the emergency credentials was in there.
Yes. That one is statistically significant and negative, a coefficient of negative 1.47. So having more teachers who lack full credentials does appear to drag scores down. But the big takeaway here is just how dominant those socioeconomic factors are.
Which explains why California eventually changed their system. They created that similar schools index.
Right.
Instead of comparing a rich suburban school to an inner city school and saying, you know, the suburban school is better, they started comparing schools with similar demographic profiles, apples to apples.
Which is, in essence, a practical application of the concept of controlling for variables.
Uh-huh.
They realized they couldn't control for it in the classroom, so they decided to control for it in the ranking system.
So lesson one, correlation is messy, and socioeconomic factors can mask other inputs because of multicollinearity. All right, let's shift gears completely. We are leaving the classroom and heading to the factory.
Case study number two, the Cobb-Douglas production function.
This takes us way back to the roots of economic theory. We're looking at data from U.S. manufacturing between 1899 and 1922.
Yeah, this is the era of the assembly line, the second industrial revolution, a really transformative period.
And the goal here is to model output. You know, how much stuff does a factory produce? And the theory says output, which we call Q, is determined by two main inputs. Capital K, that's machines, buildings, tools.
And labor, L, the workers.
Okay. Now, if I just add one machine, does my output go up by a fixed amount every time?
Probably not. And that's the core of the problem. The famous Cobb-Douglas formula looks like this. Q equals alpha times K to the power of beta 2 times L to the power of beta 3. It involves exponents.
Which means it's not a straight line. It's a curve.
Exactly. Think about what a production curve looks like. When you have zero machines and you add your first one, your productivity just skyrockets. The curve is really steep.
Right.
But when you already have 1,000 machines and you add one more, it doesn't help as much. The curve flattens out. That's diminishing marginal returns.
And the problem is that OLS ordinarily squares, our standard regression tool, it hates curves. It only knows how to draw straight lines. If you try to fit a straight line through a curved data set, you're just going to get garbage results.
Total garbage. So do we throw out the tool? No. We transform the data. And this is one of the most powerful tricks in the econometric toolkit, the natural logarithm transformation.
Taking the log. I remember this vaguely from high school math, but explain it intuitively. Why does taking the log of the data straighten out the curve?
The easiest way to think of it is that it squashes the axis.
Mm-hmm.
A logarithmic scale compresses large numbers. And mathematically, it has this beautiful property where it turns multiplication into addition.
Okay.
If you have A times B and you take the log, it becomes log of A plus log of B.
And what happens to those exponents?
Yeah.
Betas.
That's the real magic. In logarithms, if you have K to the power of beta, the beta just drops down in front. It becomes beta times the log of K. So our curved power function turns into a beautiful, simple, linear equation. The log of Q equals an intercept plus beta 2 times the log of K plus beta 3 times the log of L.
Wow. So we've basically translated a complex physical reality diminishing returns, these curves, into a language that the regression model can actually understand. It's now a straight line in log world.
Precisely. Now we can run OLS. So let's look at the results for U.S. manufacturing, 1899 to 1922.
Okay, looking at the table. For capital, the log of K, the coefficient is 0.233. For labor, the log of L, the coefficient is 0.807.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have to be very careful with interpretation here. In the school example, the coefficient meant points per year.
Yeah.
But we are in log world now.
Yes. This is critical. In a log-log model like this one, the coefficients represent elasticity. This is a percentage concept.
Okay, so explain the 0.233 for capital.
It means that if you increase capital by 1%, output increases by 0.23%.
Okay, got it. And for labor, the coefficient is 0.807. So a 1% increase in labor leads to a 0.81% increase in output.
Which tells us something really fascinating about that specific era of history. Labor was the much, much stronger driver. Increasing your workforce had about 4 times the impact on output compared to increasing your capital stock by the same percentage.
That is really interesting. Now, there's another massive economic concept we can test with these two numbers, returns to scale.
Yes, this is the question that keeps antitrust regulators up at night. If I double my size, if I double my machines, and I double my workers, do I get double the output?
If you do, that's called constant returns to scale.
Right. If you get less than double, that's decreasing returns, which means you're probably getting too big and bureaucratic. But if you get more than double, that's increasing returns to scale.
And that implies that getting bigger actually makes you more efficient.
It does. And if getting bigger makes you more efficient, the biggest company will always crush the smaller ones, and you end up with a natural monopoly.
So looking at 1899, 1922, what happened?
Well, in the math, we just add the exponents. If beta 2 plus beta 3 equals 1, we have constant returns.
Okay, let's do the math. 0.233 plus 0.807 equals 1.040.
It's very close to 1. But is it statistically different from 1? You know, is that 0.040 extra bit just noise, or is it real increasing returns?
I would guess that.
We run a hypothesis test, specifically an F-test. We're testing the null hypothesis that the sum equals exactly 1.
And what's the result?
The p-value comes back at 0.636.
Wow, that is a huge p-value.
It's massive. It means we absolutely cannot reject the null hypothesis. Statistically speaking, 1.040 is indistinguishable from 1.0, given the noise in the data.
So the verdict is, the U.S. manufacturing sector in the early 20th century exhibited constant returns to scale. It fits the competitive market theory perfectly.
Exactly. But before we leave this case study, we have to address a little technical gremlin. The notes here mention HAC errors.
HAC, heteroscedasticity, and autocorrelation consistent standard errors. Okay, that is a mouthful. We've talked about heteroscedasticity before, but let's talk about autocorrelation. This is a problem specifically because we're dealing with time, right?
Yes. This is time series data. We have 1899, 1900, 1901, and so on.
And time is sticky.
It is. I mean, imagine you're measuring the temperature. If it's hot today, it's probably going to be hot tomorrow.
Yeah.
The weather isn't independent day to day. And economic data is the same.
Sure.
If there was a big shock to the economy in 1900, maybe a financial panic or a war, that shock doesn't just vanish when the calendar turns to 1901. It lingers.
So the error term, the random noise in our model in 1900, is related to the error term in 1901. They're not independent.
Correct.
Yeah.
We call that serial correlation.
Yeah.
And the problem is standard OLS assumes that every single data point is a brand new independent roll of the dice.
So if we use standard OLS on time series data, the model thinks it has more independent information than it actually does.
It gets overconfident. Exactly. It makes the standard errors too small, which makes the T statistics look too big. We might think a result is significant when it's really just, you know, a heat wave of data where everything moved together.
So HAC errors are the reality check.
They are. They widen the margins of error to account for that historical hangover, for that stickiness over time.
So the lesson from the factory. Logarithms let us model curves, elasticities tell us about percentage changes, and when you're dealing with time, you need HAC errors to stop you from lying to yourself about precision.
Precisely. That's a perfect summary.
Okay, let me mentally bookmark that. We've got control variables and multicollinearity from the school example. We've got log transformations and HAC errors from the factory. We're building a real toolkit here.
We are.
But now we need to talk about what happens when the tool itself breaks.
Case study number 3. The Phillips curve.
This is, I think, arguably the most dramatic story in all of macroeconomics. It has a rise, a fall, and a resurrection.
It really does. So the Phillips curve describes the trade-off between unemployment and inflation.
And the logic seems pretty sound. If unemployment is low, everyone has a job. Labor is scarce, so workers demand higher wages.
And companies raise prices to pay for those wages. So low unemployment leads to high inflation.
And the reverse. If unemployment is high, nobody asks for a raise and prices stabilize. Low inflation. It's a seesaw. You can't have both ends down at the same time.
That's the theory.
Let's look at phase one, the good era, the data from 1949 to 1969.
If we run a regression of inflation on unemployment for those years, it works beautifully. We get a coefficient of 901.030.
Negative, meaning the trade-off is real. Lower unemployment is associated with higher inflation.
And it's highly significant. The T statistic is -3.17. Policymakers in the 60s looked at this and thought they had discovered a law of physics. They thought, great, we can just pick a point on the curve, let's stimulate the economy, lower unemployment, and we'll just accept, say, 3% inflation as the cost of doing business.
They thought they could just dial it in. They could engineer the economy, and then came the 1970s.
Phase two, the breakdown. Let's look at the data from 1970 to 2014. If we run the exact same regression, inflation on unemployment, what happens?
The coefficient flips. It becomes positive 0.266.
Stop and think about what that implies. A positive correlation means that high unemployment is associated with high inflation.
Which shouldn't happen. That's the worst of both worlds.
We had a name for it. Stagflation. A stagnant economy with high unemployment plus inflation.
And what did it look like statistically? Was it significant?
Not at all. The relationship was statistically insignificant. The model completely fell apart. The R-squared dropped to near zero. If you were an economist in 1975 relying on that 1960s model, you were looking out the window and seeing a world that contradicted your math entirely.
It was a crisis for the whole field. But then econometricians started to realize something was missing. The model was too simple. It assumed people are, like, robots who only look at current prices.
Right. But people aren't dumb. People have expectations. If a union leader expects inflation to be 5% next year, they're going to demand a 5% raise now, regardless of what the unemployment rate is today.
Okay, so that's the missing piece. This leads us to phase three, the augmented Phillips curve. We fix the model by adding a new variable, expinflation expected inflation.
Right. We use data from the Survey of Professional Forecasters to get a good estimate of what people thought inflation was going to be. Now we regress inflation on two things, unemployment and expected inflation.
And does it work?
It works like magic. First, the coefficient for expected inflation comes in at 1.147. That's very close to 1. It means if people expect inflation to go up by 1%, actual inflation goes up by about 1%. It's basically a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Okay, that makes sense. But what happened to our old friend unemployment, the variable that looked completely broken?
The coefficient flipped back. It's now negative 0.128.
So the negative relationship, the trade-off, it was there all along. It was just hiding.
It was being masked. And this brings us to what might be the most important methodological lesson of the day, omitted variable bias, or OVB.
We need to define this really clearly because this is the killer of so many bad studies. What exactly is OVB?
OVB happens when you leave a variable out of your model, in this case expectations, that satisfies two specific conditions. One, it helps determine the outcome. So expectations definitely affect inflation.
Okay.
And two, it's correlated with your other variables. So expectations were correlated with unemployment.
Let's trace that. In the 70s, did we have high expectations of inflation?
Yes, absolutely. Because of oil shocks and bad policy.
And did we have high unemployment?
We did. So the two variables were moving together. They were positively correlated.
So when we ran the simple model, the unemployment variable was trying to do double duty. It was trying to capture its own effect plus the effect of these rising inflation expectations.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you could even visualize the formula for bias. You have the true coefficient, which is negative, and then you add this bias term. And the bias term is the product of two things. The effect of the missing variable on the outcome, which was huge,
right,
times the correlation between the missing variable and the one you included, which was positive and high.
So you took a huge positive effect and added it to the true negative effect.
And that created a massive positive bias. It was so strong that it took the true negative coefficient, dragged it all the way up through zero, and made it look positive.
A sign reversal.
Yes.
Yeah.
A sign reversal going from negative to positive or vice versa is the classic textbook symptom of severe omitted variable bias. That positive result in the 70s wasn't real economic behavior. It was a statistical artifact of leaving out the most important variable in the room.
That is such a powerful lesson. A model can work for 20 years and then just fail completely because a variable that used to be constant, like expectations, suddenly started moving around.
Precisely. It's a cautionary tale.
All right. We've covered schools, factories, and inflation. Those are all regression models. But sometimes even a good regression isn't enough to prove causality. Sometimes the omitted variable bias is just too hard to fix because maybe we can't measure the missing variable.
This is where we enter the realm of advanced causal methods. We're going to look at four specific tools that economists use when the going gets tough.
Okay, let's do a kind of methodological speed round. We'll start with a puzzle about cars, the auto efficiency study.
The question here is a simple one. We have much better technology now than we did in 1980. Engines are way more efficient, thermodynamics has improved, so why does the gas mileage for the whole fleet, you know, triple?
We looked at the Audi 2S MPG dataset from 1980 to 2006. If you run a log-log regression of MPG on some measure of efficiency technology you find, well, you find disappointment.
You find that the efficiency gains were almost completely negated. And the reason is that while the engines got better, the cars themselves changed. We wanted bigger cars, SUVs, we wanted more horsepower, we wanted safety features which add weight.
So the technology gain was spent on moving heavier metal faster, not on saving gas.
Exactly. And methodologically, this study is important because it used cluster-robust standard errors. They clustered by manufacturer.
Why cluster by manufacturer? What does that do?
Because the errors aren't random. The design choices Ford makes this year are probably related to the choices Ford makes next year. And Ford's design philosophy is different from Toyota's. If we didn't cluster, we'd be treating every single car model as a totally independent invention, which is just false.
Got it. Okay, next method. This is the gold standard. Randomized control trials, or RCTs.
This is how we try to solve the selection bias problem once and for all. The case study here is the famous RAND health insurance experiment. The question was, does having to pay for healthcare make you spend less on it?
It seems obvious. It's the law of demand. If something's cheaper, you buy more of it. But why couldn't we just look at observational data? Why not just compare people who have free insurance to people who have expensive insurance?
Because in the real world, who chooses the free but expensive premium insurance?
Duh.
Sick people. People who know they're going to need a lot of care. So if you just look at the data, you'd see people with good insurance spend a ton on health care. You might wrongly conclude the insurance caused the spending.
When really, the pre-existing sickness caused both the insurance choice and the spending.
Exactly. That is classic selection bias. So how did RAND fix it?
They forced the choice.
They took families and randomly assigned them to different plans. Some got totally free care, a 0% copay, while some had to pay 95% of the bill.
And because it was random.
The groups were identical on average. Same number of sick people, same age, same income, you name it. The only systematic difference between the groups was the price of care.
And the results.
People with free care spent significantly more. The demand for healthcare slopes downward, just like the demand for bananas or cars. Randomization allowed us to prove that cleanly.
But we can't always randomize. We can't randomly assign a recession to one state and not another. So what do we do then?
We can use difference in differences. Or did he? The case study here is South Africa in 1994. They wanted to know if building new health clinics in communities actually improved kids' health.
But again, you can't just look at communities with clinics, because maybe the government built the clinics in the poorest areas first, or maybe in the areas with the best roads. There's always a reason.
Right. So DID does something very clever. It looks at the change over time. We compare the change in health for kids in treatment communities, where a clinic was built, against the change in health for kids in control communities, where no clinic was built.
So if the whole country was getting healthier just because the economy was improving, that trend would show up in the control group's change.
Exactly. We subtract that background trend. Whatever extra improvement happens in the clinic group, that's the causal effect of the clinic.
And in South Africa, did it work?
It did. Weight for age scores for kids increased by 0.522. The clinics worked.
Okay, next method. Regression discontinuity, or RD. To me, this is the most magical one. It feels like finding a glitch in the matrix that you can exploit for science.
It's a beautiful design.
Yeah.
It's used when there's a strict cutoff rule for something. The case study here is political incumbency. We want to know, does winning an election give you an advantage in the next election?
But winners are usually just better politicians. They have more charisma, more money. How do we separate that incumbency advantage from just being a better candidate?
We look at the razor-thin margins. We compare a candidate who won with 50.1% of the vote to a candidate who lost with 49.9% of the vote.
Statistically, those two people are basically identical.
Effectively, yes. The difference between 50.1% and 49.9% is a rainy day or a traffic jam near a polling place. It's essentially random luck. It's as good as an RCT right at that cutoff.
So we have two identical candidates, but one gets the incumbent label and all that comes with it, and one doesn't. And we just watch what happens 2 years later.
And the result is striking. The one who got lucky and won the first time has a 5% to 7% advantage in the next race. Just holding the office, having the name recognition, the franking privileges, is worth a huge number of votes.
Last one in the speed round. Instrumental variables, or IV.
This is probably the most complex one conceptually. The question is a big one. Do better institutions, like rule of law, property rights, cause higher GDP?
And the problem is the loop. Rich countries can afford to have good courts and police. Poor countries can't. So does wealth cause good institutions? Or do good institutions cause wealth? It's a chicken and egg problem.
Exactly. To solve it, we need an instrument. Something that affects institutions but has no direct effect on GDP today. We need a random shock from history.
And the researchers, Acemoglu and his colleagues, found a wild one. Settler mortality from the 1600s and 1700s.
It sounds grim, but follow the logic. In places where European settlers died at very high rates, from things like malaria or yellow fever, they didn't move in. They didn't settle. Instead, they just set up extractive states. They just wanted to take the gold or the rubber and get out, so they set up terrible institutions designed for plunder.
But in places where the mortality rate was low, like the U.S. or Australia, New Zealand, they moved their families, they built neo-Europes, they demanded property rights, trials by jury, checks on power.
Exactly. And here is the kicker. Those institutions stuck. The extractive institutions in the high mortality zones persisted for centuries, and the inclusive institutions in the low mortality zones also persisted.
So we use 17th century mosquito bites, basically this settler mortality, to predict 20th century institutions. And since a mosquito bite in 1600 can't possibly affect a factory's output in 2024 directly,
it breaks the loop. It's a valid instrument. Right. So if we see that those low mortality places are richer today, it must be because of the better institutions they built.
And the result.
Better institutions causally lean to higher GDP. It's a massive foundational finding in economics, and it was only possible because they found that incredibly clever instrument.
It really is detective work.
It is. Econometrics isn't just crunching numbers. It's finding these clever ways to trick the universe into revealing its secrets.
Now, before we wrap up, we have to talk about the unglamorous side of this. We've talked about the math, the models, the breakthroughs, but where does all the data come from in the first place?
Ah, yes. Part 5, data wrangling, or as I like to call it, the part of the job that makes you want to quit.
The source material lists the steps so cleanly. Ingestion, merging, cleaning. It sounds like a simple recipe.
It is not a recipe. It is a battle. Let's just talk about merging. In that school example, you have API scores in one file and census data in another. You have to link them together.
Just use the school name, right? Simple.
No, oh, only. In one file, it's Lincoln High. In the other, it's Abraham Lincoln High School. In a third, it's Lincoln HS, North District. The computer sees those as three completely different things.
Oh, no. So you have to go in and fix them by hand.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Or you rely on ID numbers, but then sometimes those get typed in wrong. A huge portion of econometric errors happen right here at this stage. You lose observations. You mismatch data. It's a mess.
And then cleaning.
You have to look for impossible numbers. If you see an API score of 1,200 and you know the maximum is 1,000, you have a problem. Is it a typo? Did someone add extra credit? You can't just run the regression. You have to investigate.
The implication, then, is that you can't run a regression until you've done all this janitorial work.
Experienced econometricians will tell you 80% of the time is finding and cleaning the data. The regression we just talked about for 45 minutes, that takes, 3 seconds to run in Stata or Python. Getting the data ready to run takes 3 weeks.
A very sobering reality check for all the aspiring analysts listening in.
Indeed. Garbage in, garbage out. It's the first rule.
So let's summarize what we've learned today on this study dive.
We covered a lot of ground. We started with schools. We learned that socioeconomic variables like parent education are powerful predictors, but they can overwhelm other signals because of multicollinearity. We learned that to find the effective teachers, we have to control for the parents.
Then we went to manufacturing with Cobb Douglas. We learned how to use logarithms to linearize a curve. We learned that in log models, coefficients are elasticities, these percentage changes. And we used F-tests to confirm that U.S. manufacturing had constant returns to scale back then.
We looked at the Phillips curve. We saw a model breakdown due to omitted variable bias. We learned the formula for bias. It's the effect of the omitted variable times its correlation with the included one. And we learned that a sign reversal is a giant red flag that you've missed a key driver.
And we toured the advanced methods using randomization, difference in differences, and regression discontinuity to solve that correlation is not causation problem when simple regression fails.
And finally, we acknowledge that clean data is just plain hard work.
It is a lot, but the theme here is so clear. Econometrics is about being a detective. It's about being skeptical of the first number you see.
Absolutely. The bivariate regression, that simple correlation, is almost always wrong. Or at least, it's woefully incomplete. The truth requires digging deeper, controlling for confounders, and constantly checking your assumptions.
I want to leave our listeners with a final thought. We saw with the Phillips curve how a solid economic law held for 20 years, 1949 to 1969. I mean, everyone relied on it. And then, because of a shift in human psychology and expectations, it broke.
It completely shattered.
It makes you wonder. We have models today that we rely on for interest rates, for inflation, for supply chains. Which of our current solid economic laws are just one shift in public psychology away from falling apart? Are we looking at a 1969 Phillips curve right now and we just don't know it?
That is the question that keeps econometricians up at night. the structure of the world changes, and our models are only as good as the history they're built on.
Something to mull over. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. We hope this helps you on your journey into the data.
Keep questioning the numbers.
See you next time.